Oh, good morning, everyone, and thank you, Mac, for the kind introduction, and thank you to David Norquist for the invitation. And to both of you, really, thank you for your many years of service and leadership and support for the Defense Department. Before I go on, I want to acknowledge the tragic MV-22 accident in Darwin, Australia, and express my condolences to the families who've lost loved ones. I also want to convey my prayers for those Marines who were injured, for their families, and for their caregivers. And let me also extend my sympathy to the people of Hawaii for the deaths of so many in Maui, and for those who've lost homes, communities, livelihoods, and everything they've known. For the U.S. defense community, these shocks are a reminder that just as hundreds of DoD personnel have been actively engaging in the ongoing response in Hawaii, right now, as we take respite from late summer heat and humidity, U.S. sailors and Marines are steaming through the Western Pacific, alongside close allies like Australia and Japan, collectively upholding our commitment to the security and stability that enables a free, open, peaceful, and prosperous Indo-Pacific. Today, as we enjoy this air-conditioned ballroom, on bases from Guam to Okinawa to Korea to Hawaii to Alaska, U.S. airmen and guardians are on watch in the skies and into space, ensuring those domains too stay free of conflict, enabling commerce and information to freely flow around the world. Today, as speeches and panels give way to networking breaks and receptions, on another Pacific shore, American soldiers in Washington State are training to maneuver and fire the Army's latest long-range hypersonic weapon. And as part of a global force with global responsibilities, their fellow service members are deployed around the world, from NATO's eastern frontier to the Strait of Hormuz to sub-Saharan Africa and beyond. There's a reason we call them warfighters, because for most of this century, many of them have indeed been fighting wars. And while I'm glad to say that they and we are not at war today, we cannot forget that all of them are still counting on all of us to deliver safe and reliable combat-credible capabilities at speed and scale so they can deter aggression and win if called to fight. Those words, warfighter, deliver, speed, and scale, are at the core of how Secretary Austin and I have sought to drive innovation throughout the Defense Department, especially in this enduring era of strategic competition with the PRC. While DoD has always had an imperative to innovate, there's no mistaking why that imperative has taken on more urgency in recent years. Because the main strategic competitor we face today is different from the rival we faced during the Cold War, a rival who was relatively slow and lumbering compared to the PRC of the present. And while America shed blood and treasure over 20 years of war in Iraq and Afghanistan, the PRC worked with focus and determination to build a modern military, carefully crafting it to blunt the operational advantages we've enjoyed for decades. But the one advantage they could never blunt, steal, or copy, no matter how hard they try, because it's embedded in our people, is American ingenuity. Our ability to innovate, change the game, and in the military sphere, to imagine, create, and master the future character of warfare. And not only militarily, it's part of what makes our systems different. America and our like-minded friends and allies have such vibrant commercial innovation ecosystems because we also have free and open societies of imaginative inventors, doers, and problem solvers. We don't seek to crush or control innovation or to make it toe the party line. Instead, our goal is to seed, spark, and stoke the flames of innovation. That's a big reason why the Secretary and I bet on our free market system over the PRC's statist economy any day of the week. And we believe in our capacity to innovate and indeed out-innovate our competitors because we've seen us do it time and again. DoD's past innovation pursuits often had labels specific to their times and origins: the revolution in military affairs, transformation, offset strategies, the Defense Innovation Initiative. Those are just some of the monikers applied to U.S. defense efforts over the decades. But no matter the name, they all shared a simple and compelling proposition to create and exploit change as a military opportunity. And whether the innovation comes from new technology or new concepts for mature technologies or new ways to build or buy or use our capabilities or new sources of such innovations, whether originating within DoD or outside as they increasingly do, today, in the face of our pacing challenge, our task is to adopt and integrate innovations wherever they can add the most military value. Easier said than done, of course. I've heard all the criticisms and levied many of them myself from the inside and outside. We're too risk-averse. Can't hire the workforce we need. Can't allocate or expend resources fast enough. Budgeting and bureaucratic processes are slow, cumbersome, and Byzantine. Not enough incentive to change culture. Not enough effort to leverage non-traditional suppliers. Startups and commercial companies can't figure out how to work with us, or that Congress won't let us move faster. That our system was built for the industrial age, not the information age, let alone the age of AI. That we don't invest enough in R&D, or we invest too much in R&D, not a joke. Or the tried and true, DoD isn't doing enough on innovation. And the mirror that we've done so much, to quote an August 7th headline from National Defense Magazine, the Pentagon's innovation ecosystem is getting out of hand. Now, I'll let you in on a little secret. I agree with almost all of this. As one of the world's largest organizations, it's often hard to see ourselves clearly and get out of our own way. So I'm far from satisfied that everything is working as it should. Honestly, if I could solve all of those problems with the snap of my fingers or the sweep of a pen or the sheer force of will, I would. And so would Secretary Austin. Except we're not God, and we're old enough to know there is no Santa Claus. Because that's not how the world works, and it's not how innovation works either. There are no silver bullets when it comes to innovation. Of course, silver bullets make for great headlines, but pretending they're real helps no one, certainly not our warfighters. Here's another secret. When it comes to delivering capabilities to warfighters at speed and scale, just having an office in Silicon Valley won't do it. That's necessary, but not sufficient. Just being able to do other transaction authorities agreements won't do it. That's necessary, but not sufficient. And even then, just doing OTAs isn't enough either. Because once you enter a deal, that capability still must be put into warfighters' hands, integrated into operational concepts and plans, produced at scale, and deployed to the field. The reality is that we face an accumulation of challenges. Most don't lend themselves to singular broad brush fixes. The most obvious ones were addressed years ago. The ones left that we can actually solve ourselves tend to be, let's just say, wonky, not headline grabbing. But if they aren't tackled, our gears will still grind too slowly, and our innovation engines still won't run at the speed and scale we need. And that we cannot abide. Let's be clear, we all know the challenges and we all know the stakes. This is not about understanding the problems or a lack of leadership focus or insufficient resources. This is about systematically tackling the highest barriers to enabling and unleashing the potential of U.S. and partner innovations, some in DoD or our labs or elsewhere in government, but most of all outside of it. That means we must first see the whole of the defense innovation ecosystem to lower the myriad barriers that get in our way. And then we must do the hard government work of removing those most damaging innovation obstacles, which is exactly what we've been doing. Over the last 2.5 years, we've been systematically mapping and debugging the DoD innovation ecosystem. First, we map the entire ecosystem from whenever a company or an operational need first enters it, through R&D and transition all the way to acquisition and sustainment. We then dug deep, working with many of you, to identify nearly 50 of the most critical pain points that companies, universities, and innovators of all kinds are experiencing, each one representing a variety of individual obstructions to innovation. And for almost a year, we've been doing the hard, methodical work of solving those pain points. Because good intentions do not drive outcomes. Putting your nose to the grindstone and demanding accountability does. For instance, we found a need to better align our S&T and acquisitions processes. That's why we started connecting our technology, acquisitions, financial, and requirements data systems together to better track where technologies transition into the hands of the warfighter and which ones. We also started aligning our modular open systems architecture standards to simplify how we upgrade DoD weapon systems and reduce costs. Candidly, we can't eliminate every pain point, like security-related roadblocks, which we can only alleviate, because a capability compromised by the enemy doesn't hold much value for the warfighter. It only puts them at greater risk. But we can do a lot, from security to workforce to transition, to make this entire ecosystem run faster and smoother for everyone, even if you're not a major defense contractor or a billionaire-backed startup. For example, we now provide free cybersecurity services to any company with a DoD contract or access to non-public DoD information. Of the dozens of tasks we've set out to tackle, we've completed about 30%, and another 50% are well on their way. Others will never really end, like sharing insights from quarterly industry roundtables across DoD. A few require specific help from Congress. And even though we're through the punch list, even then, I'm sure there will be more pain points to uncover and address, which we must and will. Just as in any enterprise, our innovation focus has a customer, and here our main customer is the warfighter. We are laser-focused from the top on customer needs and clear paths to fulfilling them. That requires resources and an ecosystem innovation that supports scaling fast, and we've worked hard on both. This is a complex system of systems. A shotgun blast approach will not work. Neither will chipping away one small piece at a time. So our approach is nonlinear, it's iterative, it's comprehensive and purposeful. It's DevSecOps. You can see that in how we've evolved the Defense Innovation Unit to the times and to the strategic imperative. And Doug Beck will talk about our DIU 3.0 approach here later tomorrow. Similarly, we've also been rapidly iterating on the foundation to deliver now a data-driven and AI-empowered military. We issued data decrees to mandate all DoD data be visible, accessible, understandable, linked, trustworthy, interoperable, and secure. Our ADA initiative deployed data scientists to every combatant command, where they're integrating data across applications, systems, and users. We've developed and awarded 4 joint warfighting cloud capability contracts to leading-edge commercial cloud providers to ensure we have computing, storage, network infrastructure, and advanced data analytics to scale on demand. We stood up DoD's Chief Digital and Artificial Intelligence Office, which is accelerating our adoption of data, analytics, and AI from the boardroom to the battlefield. The Secretary and I are ensuring CDAO is empowered to lead change with urgency, from the E-ring to the tactical edge. And we've invested steadily and smartly in accompanying technology. All this and more is helping realize combined joint all-domain command and control. This is not a platform or a single system that we're buying. It's a whole set of concepts, technologies, policies, and talent that's advancing a core U.S. warfighting function, command and control. With CJADC2, we're integrating sensors and fusing data across every domain while leveraging cutting-edge decision support tools to enable high-tempo operations. And it's making us even better than we already are at joint operations and combat integration. CJADC2 is not some futuristic dream. Based on multiple global information dominance experiments, trips to see INDOPACOM's Joint Fires Network and exercises like CENTCOM's Digital Falcon Oasis and the 18th Airborne Scarlet Dragon series. It's clear these investments are yielding returns much faster than traditional capabilities. Again, DevSecOps. That's the beauty of what software can do for hard power. Delivery doesn't take several years or a decade. Our investments in data, AI, and compute are empowering warfighters in the here and now in matters of months, weeks, and even days. And they'll be delivering even more between now and January. CJADC2 is vital, but it's only one of the key elements of U.S. warfighting advantage under the joint warfighting concept. So we've been extending more bridges and express lanes over the Valley of Death to increase urgency and speed the transition from between R&D and production and scale in important areas so we get the right capabilities to the right people in time to matter for the warfighter. For instance, we started RADR, the Rapid Defense Experimentation Reserve, a process to incentivize joint experimentation and hasten the pathway from concepts to experiments to fielding at scale. One example is systems that fuse sensor data across the battle space, enabling Marines doing island maneuvers to leverage long-range fires from the Army or Air Force. We're leveraging new pathways for middle-tier acquisition and software acquisition. By the end of this September, over $5.5 billion will have gone through the software acquisition pathway across the last three fiscal years. And we've stood up other initiatives like AppFit to accelerate procurement and fielding of advanced and innovative technologies, and competitive advantage pathfinders, or CAPs, to overcome bureaucratic and cultural barriers to delivering capabilities at scale to the warfighter. Together, these efforts are shaving 3 to 6 years off transition and delivery timelines for warfighter priorities, like expeditionary wideband, SATCOMs, anti-jam radio links, multi-counter C5ISRT capabilities, and more, arriving downrange well before the end of this decisive decade. These efforts are already making a difference, and yet we know we must do more. Across the board, the Secretary and I are personally and relentlessly focused on outcomes, not inputs. This strategic competition demands our urgency. We have no patience for lip service, foot dragging, or innovation theater. Bumper stickers and brand names don't mean much if you don't deliver outcomes. As you'll hopefully hear from other DoD speakers here, we're doing much more to drive innovation, such as elevating DIU to report directly to Secretary Austin and empowering it to help us deliver strategic impact at scale, using multi-year procurement to maximize production of long-range munitions for the Indo-Pacific, and standing up the Office of Strategic Capital to selectively find and fill gaps in private investment that could hamper our access to critical technologies. The echoes from innovations past have shaped our innovations in the present, from how we stood up CDAO in less than a year, to novel operational concepts we're developing for long-range fires, to how we've borrowed parts of the counter-IED playbook to support Ukraine after Russia's latest invasion last February. In the 18 months since then, we've sent Ukraine over 3.1 million rockets, missiles, mortars, and artillery rounds, and that's only four of the categories of munitions. We've sent and committed much more, over $43 billion of military assistance. And working with the private sector, we've also helped Ukraine access important commercial technology capabilities that have made a real difference to them on the battlefield. Whether in the past or present, innovation has advanced our military advantage when the right ingredients came together. First, an operational problem that is a customer need. Then, a potential solution with technology that's ready or ready enough to scale fast in time to matter for the warfighter. You need an atmosphere where people can test new things, big things, things that might fail, but that could also succeed in a game-changing way. And you need people at multiple levels, top down and bottom up, to see its potential, to bet big on its success and to drive it over the finish line. If you only have some of those elements, if the technology can't get there, if the need isn't clear, if there's no risk tolerance, if people aren't willing to propel it forward, you get things that fizzle, aren't adopted, or never scale. But at those alchemic moments when all the parts collide, that's when game-changing innovation really happens. And right now is one of those moments. Today, we're making another big bet, the latest piece of our comprehensive warfighting-centric approach to innovation. It's called the Replicator Initiative, and I want to tell you a bit about it. Replicator is meant to help us overcome the PRC's biggest advantage, which is mass. More ships, more missiles, more people. Before Russia invaded Ukraine again in February, they seemed to have that advantage too. But historically, even when we've mobilized our economy and manufacturing base, rarely have America's war-winning strategies relied solely on matching an adversary ship for ship or shot for shot. After all, we don't use our people as cannon fodder like some competitors do. Instead, we outmatch adversaries by outthinking, outstrategizing, and outmaneuvering them. We augment manufacturing and mobilization with our real comparative advantage, which is the innovation and spirit of our people. And so, if the operational challenge we must tackle is one of countering mass, we will do so not only through existing approaches and systems, those remain important, but we already know how to build and use today's technology. This is about mastering the technology of tomorrow. To stay ahead, we're going to create a new state of the art, just as America has before, leveraging attritable autonomous systems in all domains, which are less expensive, put fewer people in the line of fire, and can be changed, updated, or improved with substantially shorter lead times. We'll counter the PLA's mass with mass of our own, but ours will be harder to plan for, harder to hit, harder to beat. With smart people, smart concepts, and smart technology, our military will be more nimble, with uplift and urgency from the commercial sector. We've all seen in Ukraine how emerging tech developed by commercial and non-traditional companies, from Starlink to Switchblade to commercial imagery, can be decisive in defending against modern military aggression. It's a vital component to complement to traditional capabilities, which remain essential. At DoD, we've already been investing in attritable autonomous systems across the military services, DIU, the Strategic Capabilities Office, and the combatant commands themselves, and in multiple domains, self-piloting ships, uncrewed aircraft, and more. It's clear they aren't just lower cost. They can be produced closer to the tactical edge. They can be used consistent with our principles of mission command, where we empower the lowest possible echelons to innovate and succeed in the battle. And they can serve as resilient distributed systems, even if bandwidth is limited, intermittent, degraded, or denied. So now is the time to take all domain attributable autonomy to the next level, to produce and deliver capabilities to warfighters at the volume and velocity required to deter aggression or win if we are forced to fight. Since we need to break through barriers and catalyze change with urgency, we've set a big goal for Replicator: to field attritable autonomous systems at scale of multiple thousands in multiple domains within the next 18 to 24 months. And the replication won't just be happening from a production standpoint. We'll also aim to replicate and inculcate how we will achieve this goal, so we can scale what's relevant in the future again and again and again. Easier said than done? You bet. We're going to do it. To galvanize the full weight and leadership attention of the Department of Defense so that everyone does their part, and to make sure we get the right commercial uplift and integration that Replicator will need, the Secretary has asked me to personally oversee it, together with the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and will be supported by the Director of DIU, who will help us bring the full power of DoD's innovation ecosystem to bear. These capabilities will be developed and fielded in line with our responsible and ethical approach to AI and autonomous systems, where DoD has been a world leader for over a decade. And we've kept pace with change as technology has evolved. Consistent with our national defense strategy and joint warfighting concept, we will employ attritable autonomous capabilities in ways that play to our enduring advantages, the greatest being our people. That's another comparative advantage we have over the PRC. These systems will empower our warfighters, not overpower or undercut their abilities. In this respect, all domain attritable autonomous systems will help overcome the challenge of anti-access area denial systems, our ADA2, to thwart their A2AD. To be clear, America still benefits from platforms that are large, exquisite, expensive, and few. But Replicator will galvanize progress in the too slow shift of U.S. military innovation to leverage platforms that are small, smart, cheap, and many. Now, if you're a cynic or just a realist, if you're thinking, come on, Deputy, this is the Pentagon you're talking about. You are too slow. I do not blame you. Because I'm deeply, personally familiar with almost every maddening flaw in our system. But I also know that when the time is right and when we apply enough leadership, energy, urgency, and depth of focus, we can get it done. That's what America does. At DoD, we always succeed through teamwork. Replicator will be no different. From working closely with the private sector, including commercial, non-traditional, and traditional defense companies alike, to collaboration and integration with allies and partners, to our enduring partnership with Congress, which has the opportunity to be a key enabler in getting capabilities to the warfighter at speed and scale. I want to make something clear before I close. You'll never see the Secretary or me rolling out a mission accomplished banner when it comes to innovation, because we are in a persistent generational competition for advantage in which we cannot take military superiority for granted. We must ensure the PRC leadership wakes up every day, considers the risks of aggression, and concludes today is not the day. And not just today, but every day. Between now and 2027, now in 2035, now in 2049 and beyond. Innovation is vital to how we do that. We are not taking our foot off the gas, and in fact, we're accelerating. Our goal is always to deter, because competition does not mean conflict. Still, we must have combat credibility to win if we must fight. With that comes a solemn obligation to ensure our warfighters are ready, trained, and equipped for whatever may come, including if the worst comes. You're all part of how America fulfills that solemn obligation. In government, academia, industry, in DoD, on Capitol Hill, at research labs, startups, commercial companies, and major defense contractors, our warfighters are counting on you, on us, to deliver at speed and scale, to work together with greater urgency and unity of purpose, to not let them down. I don't intend to, and I know you won't either. And for that, I thank you.
Thank you for that. I'm excited about Replicator, and I want to talk more about it in just a second. But let me start with just a couple of more general questions. You listed some of the buzzwords that have been used in the past, revolutionary military affairs, transformation, and so forth. I've noticed that when something becomes fashionable, then that label gets slapped on everything, whether it is or not. The latest buzzword is innovation. What does the buzz get right, and what does the buzz get wrong about that?
Yeah, innovation has a purpose. Innovation, again, as I as said in the military context, is about, you know, creating advantage, creating capability. And certainly in the commercial sector, that's what innovation is about. You sometimes hear people say innovation for innovation's sake, which I think is counter to the definition of innovation. But I take the general point they're trying to make, which, again, is sort of the innovation theater piece of it, which is we've created an organization. We've, you know, put small dollars in a capability. But there isn't real thought and design thinking in how it's responding to a customer demand and how we're actually going to get it across the finish line. So I think that's, you know, the current debate over innovation. Are people serious about it? Do they understand that innovation is always about making something better? And how we prove that out in our system?
The National Defense Strategy talks about incorporating emerging technologies to solve key operational challenges. So I mentioned in the introduction, you're the COO for the largest employer in the world. Where does incorporating emerging technologies to solve operational challenges fit in your priorities of where you spend your time and so forth?
Yeah, it's a major priority. My top priority is making sure we put out the capabilities to outmatch, to be able to solve the generational challenge put forward by the PRC. I said that in my confirmation hearing back in February of 2021, and it remains true to this day. And the way I effectuate that is obviously through how I spend my time, the accountability I create in the system for delivering those capabilities. Back to innovation. Innovation, as I said, is a vital tool to how we deliver the capabilities. It is part of how we get to the outcome we want. It is not generally an outcome unto itself. But just to show you some of the ways I've invested that time and energy, I mentioned quite a few of the initiatives in there that we've spent a lot of time building that I've personally overseen. In addition, we've now created the Deputies Innovation Steering Group. At the beginning of the administration, I created our Innovation Steering Group with Undersecretary Hsu right here, chaired for us. What we found is that there was a need in the system to pull that work up systematically to the deputy secretary level and allow Undersecretary Hsu to pull the CTOs of DOD together more routinely. So that's what we've done now. And we will use that DISG, because everything has an acronym. That DISG will be the driving engine for Replicator. We also created a body that will feed that Doug Beck, director of DIU, who is a direct report now, will lead. And that'll help us drive Replicator in that way. So honestly, a lot of it you can see just by virtue of the outcomes we've achieved. And the focus that we've kept in terms of our meeting cadence and the deliverables.
Okay. As you know, about a month ago, Defense Innovation Board had a report that quoted former Secretary Gates saying the only way to move something with urgency in the department is for the secretary or the deputy secretary to grab hold of it. Sounds to me like you've grabbed hold of Replicator. And what I heard was specific targets, thousands of things in 18 to 24 months for a particular purpose. What's the biggest problem going to be in making it happen?
Scaling the production is the area we're going after with Replicator. We have, as we looked at that innovation ecosystem, we think we've got some solutions in place, as I said, across many of those pain points, but the scaling piece is the one that still feels quite elusive, scaling for emerging technology, and that's what we're really going to go after with Replicator. How do we get those multiple thousands produced and in the hands of warfighters in 18 to 24 months? We obviously have done our homework. We know we can do it. It doesn't mean it's without risk, and we got to take a big bet here, but what's leadership without big bets and making something happen? So that's what we're going to do.
And I assume that some amount of private capital is going to be necessary to scale up the production to have thousands of whatever it is coming off. So part of the plan has to be an attraction for companies to put their resources and people onto this project.
Well, we'll spell out the details of Replicator in the coming weeks. We're going to be cagey. In terms of what we want to share, particularly with the PRC. And we're going to work very closely with Admiral Aquilino and our other COCOMs on what some of those most ripe operational challenges are, where the technology's in the right place and we think we've got the production capability going. We have a lot of work going on across the department. This is really about unifying those efforts and scaling them up and getting through the pain points. As I mentioned, you know, we see just head-scratching, amazing, awful sort of examples every day of things that get hung up that don't need to be hung up. And we're going to drive through that. We've been driving through it in other areas, and I gave some examples. But I think the key, the other double entendre piece of Replicator is we're going to take what we do here, this culture change, this getting through those myriad problems, and we're going to let that replicate throughout the system because it is not realistic to have a system where only two people, the Secretary and the Deputy Secretary of Defense, can effectively oversee the 3 million people and all of the requirements that go with it. It's a very challenging system, no doubt, but the culture change we need has to be all the way through the system. We can help a lot from the top, and we're going to do that, but there's also a lot of ingenuity and ambition in the rest of the force and, of course, out in industry and on Capitol Hill, and we want to inspire that.
Well, okay. I'm sorry, one more question on this. People said, you talked about JADC2 as well as Replicator. People talk about that the department is not where it needs to be on software to make things like that, both of them, work. How do you feel about where we are in the software that is essential for something like Replicator or JADC2?
Yeah, I think that we're in a great place in terms of commercial industry having so much to offer, and we're very well lashed up. I think it is a major culture change for folks who are used to hardware acquisition to shift to the way in which one acquires and sustains and continues to upgrade software and how we think about open system architecture. And that's where developing CDAO, getting the cloud infrastructure, and all the other pieces that we've laid in, those are all foundational. They had to happen, and I think they're going to really help us accelerate software. I mentioned we've got more than $5 billion in just 3 fiscal years through software acquisition pathway. I think we can keep scaling that up, and that middle-tier acquisition pathway that was created during the prior administration, I think that's a great accelerant, and we're going to continue to use it.
Okay. You mentioned Congress. What do you need from them to make Replicator really happen or some of these other goals that you've laid out?
Yeah, I think we have a lot of folks on Capitol Hill who are very seized with the same urgency about the PRC challenge. And are excited at prospects to create some change in the system. So we're going to work with all those innovators out there. And again, I think they're in both chambers and then they're among our appropriators and among our authorizers. So we're excited to work with them. We do need steady and predictable appropriations. We're in August and there's already talks about a shutdown. That's not good. Not just for Replicator, but for everything in the Defense Department. And we have become too used to working under CRs. I think that's deeply unhealthy, and I don't know how we compete effectively with the PRC when we are in that kind of hold pattern for so long. And we need our folks confirmed. We need to make sure we have the leadership in place to drive change. Leadership matters. We've just talked about that. Everyone knows that, whether you're on the sports field or you're, on the battlefield or in the Defense Department. So those are the kinds of things we look forward to working with Congress on.
Okay. One more question. Non-traditional defense suppliers who are interested but kind of skeptical about doing business with DOD, what would your message to them be? Or what's your advice to them?
Yeah, I think my message to them is, this is a generational challenge to American society. We support, as I said, we support your independence, and we understand the advantage we get in innovation from them being able to thrive, and we want to work with you, we want to take advantage of it, and we're learning every day how to do it better. We have seen a tremendous amount of dare